O'Brien crosses to the desk and writes on the pad in front of Steve. We see what she has written. It says, "Take deep breaths."
The defense calls George Sawicki.
Cut to close-up of George Sawicki.
Mr. Sawicki, do you know the defendant sitting at this table?
I've known Steve for 3 years. He's been in my film club.
Can you give us your opinion of Mr. Harmon's work?
I think he's an outstanding young man. He is talented, bright, and compassionate. He's very much involved with depicting his neighborhood and environment in a positive manner.
Do you consider him an honest young man?
Absolutely.
When he says he was taking mental notes for a film, would that be a film for your club?
Yes.
Nothing further.
Close-up of Mr. Sawicki. He starts to leave the stand, but is held up by the judge.
You said you're a teacher in Mr. Harmon's school. Do you live in his neighborhood?
No, I don't.
So, although you want to vouch for his character, isn't it fair to say that you don't know what he does when he goes to his neighborhood and you go home to yours?
No, it's not. His film footage shows me what he's seeing and, to a large extent, what he's thinking. And what he sees, the humanity of it, speaks of a very deep character.
What was he doing on the afternoon of December 22nd? Did he show you a film of that day?
No, he did not.
Do you feel that the ability to make a film means that someone is honest?
It is my belief that to make an honest film, one has to be an honest person. I would say that. And I do believe in Steve's honesty.
As a matter of fact, you like him quite a bit, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Nothing further.
Harmon rests.
King rests.
Cut to Steve lying on his cot, soaked with sweat. He tries hard to catch his breath. He turns his head to the wall. He lifts one hand and lets it slide slowly down the pale green wall. Cut to interior courtroom, close up of James King. He looks around awkwardly as Briggs sums up his defense.
So what do we have? We have a man who admits to being part of a robbery, accusing another man. And why is he making these accusations? The prosecution would have you believe that bringing Mr. Evans, this Bobo character, here is the result of good police work, which gives Mr. Evans the chance to demonstrate what a great citizen he is. But isn't the truth of the matter that the only reason he's here is because the police have him on a criminal matter and have offered him a deal if he comes here and implicates someone else? Isn't that the real story? Does it really surprise anyone that a man who is capable of robbing a drugstore, and he has admitted to doing just that, who then sells the loot from the robbery, and he has admitted to that, and who is caught with the drugs, and he has admitted to that, then tries to get a lighter sentence by testifying against another person? Isn't his character, if you can call it character, clear? Hasn't he proven by his own admissions who he is, what he is?
Camera pulls back from POV of judge. We see only Mr. and Mrs. Harmon on one side of courtroom, a few strangers on the other side. The courtroom is nearly empty. The camera pans to court clerk, who was going through mail, then to court stenographer, who takes down proceedings, then to court officer, who is nodding, close to sleep.
What I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is that Mr. Evans made the mistake of selling the cigarettes he stole during the robbery. Did he do the shooting? I don't know. But naturally he says he didn't do it. If he had sat up there on the witness stand and said he did the shooting, he would never have been offered the deal he got. The only way out for him is to look around and find somebody else to accuse, and that's precisely what he did. He could have picked anyone else in the neighborhood. Half the young men of that age group were either unemployed or underemployed. He happened to pick Mr. King. The state did not produce one witness to the murder. They produced one witness, Miss Henry, who said she saw Mr. King in the store. Where was her mind at the time? According to her testimony, it was on the health and well-being of her grandchild. Could she have made a mistake? Evidently she has. Not that she did not see someone in the store, but whom did she see? She was taken to the police station and given a set of photographs. From these photographs she picked, at police urging, Mr. King. But she didn't pick out this photo from 1,000 photographs, or a book of photographs, or even 50 photographs. She was shown a handful of photos and asked to pick one. Later, when she had to pick someone from a lineup, what was she doing? Was she picking out the man she saw in the drugstore? Or was she picking out the man the police had given her in the photographs? That's for you, the jury, to decide. We heard Mrs. Moore testify that James King was at her house at the time of the incident. Shall we assume that every person who is related to an accused person is going to lie? I don't think so. The prosecution, Miss Petrocelli, paraded in front of you a bunch of admitted criminals, people who have participated in stick-ups, buying and selling stolen goods, you name it. She has asked you to believe them. Then she asks you not to believe Mrs. Moore, who has never committed a crime in her life. Think about it. If you met these people on the street, which would you believe? Which would you trust? As for Osvaldo Cruz, he is putting as much distance between himself and this crime as possible. All he was supposed to do was stand outside and push a garbage can in front of a potential pursuer. But there wasn't a pursuer, because Mr. Evans and whoever he was with, if indeed he was with anyone else, made sure of that. And think about this. Laurel Henry, who seemed for all the world like a decent, law-abiding human being, testified that she was sure that there were two men in the store, two men involved in the robbery, and we have two men who have admitted participation. I submit to you that there's no need to go beyond these two men when you look for the perpetrators of this crime. Ultimately, what this case is about is whether you believe people who are admitted participants in this crime and who are saving their own hides. If you believe, as I do, that their positions, their stated characters, so taint their testimony that everything they say is well within the area of reasonable doubt, then you have no choice but to find Mr. King not guilty. And when you walk away from the sorry testimony of the state's witnesses, you have nothing else from the prosecution, nothing else. Ladies and gentlemen, at the beginning of this case, the prosecutor spoke of monsters. She not only found them, but she has brought them here to testify for the state. I have faith in you, and faith in the American judicial system. And that faith leads me to believe that justice in this case demands more proof than you have seen in this case. I believe that justice demands that you reject the testimony of these men, consigning their stories to the area of deep doubt. I believe that justice demands that you return a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
Cut to POV of jury. Camera will follow O'Brien as she paces from one side of the jury to the other. Behind her, we see the prosecutor's table and the two defense tables. Beyond that, we see Steve's mother sitting on the edge of her seat.
First, I would like to thank you for your patience in this trial and for your attentiveness. It's been clear to everyone involved in this case that you have taken an interest in these proceedings and have brought your minds and hearts to the testimony. I would like to beg your indulgence while I review that testimony. The most important testimony, the reason we're here, is the medical examiner's statement that a murder was committed. A man is dead. But nowhere in the medical examiner's testimony does he indicate who was responsible for that murder. That is for you to determine. It is an awesome responsibility. It was testified that the gun belonged to the victim, so we can't trace gun ownership back to the murderer. What can we trace as to the guilt or innocence of my client, Steve Harmon? The state doesn't even suggest that he was in the store during the robbery. It doesn't suggest that it was his gun that was used. The state does contend that somewhere, sometime, Steve got together with someone and agreed to participate in this robbery. On the stand, Steve admitted to having seen Mr. Evans on the street in his neighborhood. Hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people have seen Mr. Evans in the streets of Harlem. Perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. That doesn't make any of them guilty of a crime. The state did elicit from Steve that he spoke to Mr. King about basketball. The conversations were short and without substance. At no time did the state establish any conversation between Steve and anyone else about a robbery. Think about that for a minute. Without a plan that says that Steve entered an agreement with the robbers, what would he be charged with? Talking about basketball in the streets of Harlem? Does that now constitute a crime? Not in any law journal that I know about. The state also presents Mr. Evans' testimony that he understood that Steve was to check out the drugstore to see if it was clear. Oh, really? The state brought out a witness, one who everyone agrees has no reason to lie, Laurel Henry. Miss Henry said that she was in the drugstore when the robbery began. If someone was to make sure that the drugstore was clear, he or she made a bad job of it. Remember, it was the state that proved that the drugstore wasn't clear. And do you remember the signal that Mr. Evans said he received? He said that Stephen came out of the drugstore and didn't signal that anything was wrong. In other words, there was no signal. What is the significance of this? Well, if there were a signal, a thumbs-up sign, for example, we might expect someone in the vicinity to have noticed it. Not only did no one without a stake in this case see Steve Harmon giving a sign, Laurel Henry, a retired librarian, did not see him in the store either. And tell me, how many young black men went into that drugstore that day and walked out without making a signal? Were they all guilty of something? Do you remember Mr. Evans' testimony that they stopped for a quick bite after committing the crime? And who stopped for the quick bite? Do you remember? Let me read to you from the testimony of Mr. Bobo Evans.
O'Brien picks up notes, adjusts her glasses, and begins to read.
Mr. Evans, we took some cigarettes and left. Miss Petrocelli, then what did you do? Mr. Evans, then we went down to that chicken joint over Lenox Avenue across from the bridge. We got some fried chicken and some wedgies and some sodas. Miss Petrocelli, who was with you at this time? Mr. Evans, just me and King.
She takes off glasses and looks at jury.
Where was Steve Harmon, the alleged lookout man? Why was there no testimony that Mr. Harmon received part of the loot from this get-over? The only person we know who profited was Bobo Evans. And we know he made a profit because he sold the cigarettes. Mr. Briggs has already suggested that the major reason for the testimonies of Mr. Evans and Osvaldo Cruz was self-interest. They were brought here not to answer for their participation, but for the sole purpose of testifying against others. They both understand that the deal they get depends on their convincing you that other people are implicated. Mr. Evans suggests that he believed what the shooter told him about someone else checking out the store. But let's look at the reliability of Mr. Evans' testimony. A robbery was committed. A man was brutally killed. The killing here is the key to what these proceedings are about, not the stolen cigarettes. And you understand that. But still, Mr. Evans goes around selling the cigarettes that connect him with the crime. Did he think that was a clever move? Or is this a shallow, gullible man who doesn't think about very much of anything? Who among us can watch a man die in a drugstore and then go out for a quick bite a few blocks away? Is this a man whom we can trust to tell the truth about anything? I don't believe him. Do you? In going over my notes last night, I ran into a question. It's the prosecutor's job to bring all of the participants in a crime to justice. And so Miss Petrocelli has brought everyone she believes might have been involved to this courtroom. But why, if Stephen Harmon is innocent, would Mr. Evans want to hurt him? That bothered me quite a bit. But then I thought again about who Mr. Evans was. He had no problem at all in sticking up an innocent man, Mr. Nesbitt. You watched him testify. Did he seem at all bothered by the fact that he had left a man dead? To Mr. Evans, all Mr. Nesbitt represented was a get-over. That's what Steve Harmon is to him as well. Mr. Evans, Bobo, is perfectly willing to leave Stephen Harmon lying on a floor or wasting away in a jail cell. The only thing that Stephen Harmon is to Mr. Evans is another get-over. Finally, let us come to the character of Steve Harmon.
We see O'Brien stop and get a drink of water. Then we see her walk next to Steve.
I want you to think about his character as opposed to that of the witnesses for the state. You saw him on the stand. He answered the questions openly and honestly, as would any other young person of his age. Miss Petrocelli asked him if he was nervous. Do you remember that? The implication was that if he was nervous, it meant that he had something to hide. I submit to you, the jurors in this case, that you too would have had a degree of nervousness. He's on trial for his life. He's facing the possibility of spending his entire youth behind bars. Under the circumstances, I would have been shocked if he were not nervous. The state paraded before you witness after witness who, by their own admission, testified either to get out of jail or to prevent themselves from going to jail, or, in the case of Mr. Zinzi, to prevent himself from being sexually molested. Think of Steve Harmon's character as opposed to that of Bobo Evans. Compare Stephen Harmon to Mr. Zinzi, another of the state's witnesses. Compare him to Mr. Cruz, who admitted taking part in this crime, who admitted that to become a member of his gang, he had to slash a stranger in the face. Is there reasonable doubt as to Steve Harmon's guilt? I think the doubt was established when Laurel Henry did not identify Steve as being in the store. It was reinforced with every witness the state brought to the stand. It's up to you, the jury, to find guilt where there is guilt. It is also up to you to acquit when guilt has not been proven. There is no question in my mind that in this case, as regards Steve Harmon, guilt has not been proven. I am asking you, on behalf of Steve Harmon and in the name of justice, to closely consider all of the evidence that you have heard during this last week. If you do, I'm sure you'll return a verdict of not guilty, and that will be the right thing to do. Thank you.
Medium shot, Petrocelli from POV of jury. Behind her, we see the prosecutor's table and the two defense tables. We see the two defense lawyers watching intently. Neither Steve nor King is directly facing the camera.
I would also like to thank you for your attention in this trial. The defense has just given you its version of the facts in this case. And now it is the state's turn. Let me start by refocusing this case. The defense wants you to go into the jury room thinking that this case is about the character of Mr. Zinzi, who testified that he heard a story about someone who stole cigarettes. It is not about his character. The defense wants you to think that this case is about the character of Mr. Bolden, who bought cigarettes. It is not about his character. The defense wants you to consider the character of Osvaldo Cruz, but this case is not about whether Mr. Cruz is someone we would invite to a party or have as a friend. The defense wants you to dwell on the character of Richard Bobo Evans. He is not a nice man, they are saying, and so you should discount his testimony. But this case is not about the character of any of these witnesses. This case is about a crime that was committed on the 22nd of December, in which an innocent man, Aguinaldo Nesbitt, was brutally murdered. I don't know what kind of man Mr. Nesbitt was, but I know he did not deserve to be killed in his store, left on the floor while his killers snacked at a fast food restaurant. This case is not about the characters of Zinzi, Bolden, Cruz, or Evans. It is about Mr. Nesbitt's right to live and to enjoy the fruits of his labor. It is about the right we all have to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is the contention of the state that no one has the right to deprive us of the precious gift of life. It is the contention of the state, and it is also the law of the land. A lot has been said about the motivation of some of the witnesses. They testified, according to the defense, only because they were given a break in their sentencing. Therefore, the defense would have you believe their testimony is somehow made false. Well, let's re-examine their testimony and find out.
Cut to, close-up of judge. He is taking notes. Cut to, Petrocelli from judge's POV.
Mr. Bolden testified that he received stolen cigarettes from Mr. Evans. We know that the cigarettes were stolen from the drugstore. Jose Delgado, the drugstore clerk, testified that the cigarettes were stolen. In other words, Mr. Delgado verifies Mr. Bolden's testimony. Did he get a break in sentencing? Or was he simply telling the truth? Did you notice that none of the defense lawyers questioned the character of the clerk, or even mentioned it? They want you to forget him. Mr. Evans testified that he was actually in the drugstore, taking an active part in the robbery. No one has questioned that. He also places Mr. King in the drugstore with him on the 22nd of December. This testimony was backed up by Laurel Henry, who had gone to the drugstore to get medicine for her grandchild. Did she get a break in sentencing? Or was she merely telling the truth? When the defense talks about character, they carefully skirt around the character of Laurel Henry. Mr. Evans also testified that when he arrived at the scene, he also saw Oswaldo Cruz there. This testimony was verified by Mr. Cruz. "Yes, I was there," Mr. Cruz testified. "Yes, I was part of this robbery." We have three witnesses to the fact that James King was in the store on the 22nd of December: Mr. Evans, Mr. Cruz, and Ms. Henry. Mr. Evans testified that they did not have a gun, but intended to take Mr. Nesbitt's money by force of muscle. He said that Mr. Nesbitt produced a gun that he owned. You heard the city clerk testify that the gun used to kill Mr. Nesbitt was registered to him. Did the city clerk, who verified Mr. Evans' testimony, get a break in sentencing? Of course not. Did the defense attack his character? No. The only thing they could do was to sit and listen to the truth. Another fact that the defense did not choose to deal with is the sale of cigarettes. The sale of cigarettes to Mr. Bolden, a fact never seriously challenged by the defense, along with the verified theft of cigarettes from the drugstore, also suggests that Mr. King was present in the store during the robbery and murder. Mr. Briggs, the attorney for James King, suggests that Mr. Evans was in the drugstore by himself, or perhaps with Oswaldo Cruz. But Laurel Henry identified Mr. King as the man she saw in the drugstore. Here is a black woman, uneasy about her role in identifying a young black man, who still had the courage to testify before you and to positively identify Mr. King. Mr. Briggs' theory simply does not work. What does work is the state's theory of what happened, verified by all of the witnesses. Mr. Harmon gave the all-clear signal, and Bobo Evans and James King went into the store to rob Mr. Nesbitt. When Mr. Nesbitt tried to defend himself, the gun was taken from him, and he was shot by that man sitting right there and killed.
She points to King.
Ms. O'Brien suggests that if Mr. Harmon had actually cased the drugstore for the robbers, he would have seen Ms. Henry. In other words, he would have been a better lookout man. Well, maybe he hasn't had much experience in helping to rob drugstores. Should we feel sorry for him? For that matter, are Mr. King or Mr. Evans so accomplished in their criminal activities? This was a botched robbery, in which the perpetrators actually took very little money and a few cartons of cigarettes. And, oh yes, the life of a good man, Aguinaldo Nesbitt. If anybody does not believe that Mr. King was in the store, if they believe that Oswaldo Cruz, Laurel Henry, and Bobo Evans are all lying, that the sale of the cigarettes to Mr. Bolden means nothing, then they should find him not guilty. I don't think that is possible. If anybody looking at this case believes that the store was not cased, that Mr. Harmon just happened to be at the drugstore, although now he says he doesn't remember where he was, then they should find him not guilty. I don't think that is possible either. The truth of the matter is that Bobo Evans participated in a crime with Mr. Cruz, Mr. King, and Mr. Harmon. They are all equally guilty. The one who grabbed the cigarettes, the one who wrestled for the gun, the one who checked the place to see if the coast was clear. What would have happened if Mr. Harmon had come out of that store and gone over to Mr. King and said, "There's someone in the store"? Perhaps they would have gone someplace else to carry out their get-over. Or maybe they would have just called it a day and gone home. Steve Harmon was part of the plan that caused the death of Aguinaldo Nesbitt. I can imagine him trying to distance himself from the event. Perhaps, in some strange way, he can even say, as his attorney has suggested, that because he did not give a thumbs-up signal or some sign to that effect, that he has successfully walked the moral tightrope that relieves him of responsibility in this matter. But Aguinaldo Nesbitt is dead, and his death was caused by these men. Mr. King's attorney wants to distance Mr. King from the murder by attacking the character of the state's witnesses. But the fact of the matter is that Mr. Evans is an associate of Mr. King. If he had chosen priests and Boy Scouts as his companions, I'm sure we wouldn't be here today. But Mr. King cannot distance himself from the fact, the cold, hard fact, that a man is dead because of him. Mr. Harmon wants us to look at him as a high school student and as a filmmaker. He wants us to think, well, he didn't pull the trigger, he didn't wrestle with Mr. Nesbitt. He wants us to believe that because he wasn't in the drugstore when the robbery went down, he wasn't involved. Again, perhaps he has even convinced himself that he wasn't involved. But yes, Mr. Harmon was involved. He made a moral decision to participate in this get-over. He wanted to get paid with everybody else. He is as guilty as everybody else, no matter how many moral hairs he can split. His participation made the crime easier. His willingness to check out the store, no matter how poorly he did it, was one of those causative factors that resulted in the death of Mr. Nesbitt. None of us can bring back Mr. Nesbitt. None of us can restore him to his family. But you, you 12 citizens of our state, of our city, can bring a measure of justice to his killers. And that's all I ask of you, to reach into your hearts and minds and bring forth that measure of justice. Thank you.
Cut to exterior courtroom. The doors of the court are closed as the camera nears it. The door is pushed open and we see the interior of the courtroom. We see the jury turned toward the judge, who speaks in a quiet, almost fatherly manner. We hear his voice as the camera seems to settle down on a seat. Steve, sensing that a friend has arrived, turns and tries to smile at Mr. Sawicki, but cannot manage it through his nervousness. We look around the courtroom as the judge's voice drifts in and out.
If you believe that Mr. King was a participant in the robbery, whether he actually pulled the trigger or not, you must return a verdict of guilty. If you believe
Cut
that Mr. Harmon
Stewart portrait of George Washington on right wall, then New York State flag, then American flag, then motto over desk.
Mr. Harmon did go into the store with the purpose
Cut
of
to wall mural,
without regard to who
then jury,
pulled the trigger,
then judge.
Then you must return a verdict of guilty of felony murder.
Camera, from POV of Steve's mother, swings wildly around the room, stopping momentarily at those symbols that fill the courtroom. Throughout this time, the last words of the judge are repeated.
Then you must return a verdict of guilty of felony murder. Then you must return a verdict of guilty of felony murder. Then you must return a verdict of guilty of
Fade
felony
out.
Murder.
Fade in. Steve in cell. For the first time, James King is in the cell with him. King leans against wall, still dressed in the clothes he wore at the trial.
How you doing? You scared?
Yeah. You?
Nah, ain't nothing to it. If the man wants you, he got you. Ain't nothing to it, man.
Hey, we got a pool going. I bet you guys get life without the possibility of parole. The guys on the next block think you're gonna get 25 to life. You guys want in on it?
Cut to Steve. He looks away, then buries his face in his hands. The guard is smirking.
That a yes or a no?
Cut to two young men handcuffed together, being led to the next cell. One looks terrified. The other is putting on a show of bravado.
You guys treat me nice and I'll put in a word for you up at Greenhaven. Maybe I can get you a boyfriend that's really built.
Cut to Steve in the mess hall. He avoids looking at King. There is a shoving match down from where he sits. An inmate reaches over and takes Steve's meat with a fork. Steve looks up and sees the taker looking at him menacingly. He looks down at the tray. Then cut to Steve in cell. Outside the cell, there is a clock on the wall with a wire guard over it. The second hand moves slowly. Then cut to inmates enjoying a domino game as if they are far away from the prison in some friendly setting.
Friday afternoon, July 17th. Last night, I was afraid to go to sleep. It was as if closing my eyes was going to cause me to die. There is nothing more to do. There are no more arguments to make. Now I understand why so many of the guys who have been through it before, who have been away to prison, keep talking about appeals. They want to continue the argument, and the system has said that it is over. My case fills me. When I left the courtroom after the judge's instructions to the jury, I saw Mama clinging to my father's arm. There was a look of desperation on her face. For a moment, I felt sorry for her, but I don't anymore. The only thing I can think of is my case. I listen to guys talking about appeals, and I am already planning mine. Every word that has been said in court is burned into my brain. Steve Harmon made a moral decision, Ms. Petricelli said. I think about December of last year. What was the decision I made? To walk down the streets? To get up in the morning? To talk to King? What decisions did I make? What decisions didn't I make? But I don't want to think about decisions, just my case. Nothing is real around me except the panic. The panic and the movies that dance through my mind. I keep editing the movies, making the scenes right, sharpening the dialogue. A get-over? I don't do get-overs, I say in the movie in my mind, my chin tilted slightly upward. I know what right is, what truth is. I don't do tightropes, moral or otherwise. I put strings in the background, cellos, violas.
King! Harmon! You got a verdict! Let's go!
Cut to courtroom, now fairly crowded. O'Brien is talking to Judge. She finishes and sits down next to Steve.
They got a verdict this morning. They've just been waiting for the Nesbitt family to arrive.
What do you think?
They have a verdict. I hope it's one we want to hear. No matter what it is, we can continue your case. We can appeal. You okay?
No.
Is everybody here? Is everybody here?
I think so.
Prosecution, ready?
Ready.
Defense?
Cut to close-up of O'Brien.
Ready.
Bring in the jury.
Words roll slowly over the screen as in the beginning. This is the true story of Steve Harmon. This is the story of his life and of his trial. We see the jury members taking their places in the jury box. It was not an episode that he expected. It was not the life or activity he thought would fill every bit of his soul or change what life meant to him. The judge has read the verdicts and hands them to the clerk as guards stand behind the defendants. He has transcribed the images and conversations as he remembers them. The color begins to fade as the jury foreman reads verdicts. Two guards begin to put handcuffs on James King as color changes to black and white. It is clear that the jury has found him guilty. We see King being taken from the courtroom. We see jury foreman as he continues to read. Cut to close-up of Steve's mother. We see her desperately clasping her hands before her, her face distorted with the tension of the moment. Then, suddenly, dramatically, she lifts her hands high and closes her eyes. Cut to the guards who were standing behind Steve move away from him. He has been found not guilty. Steve turns toward O'Brien as camera closes in and film grows grainier. Steve spreads his arms to hug O'Brien, but she stiffens and turns to pick up her papers from the table before them. Cut to O'Brien, her lips tense. She is pensive. She gathers her papers and moves away, as Steve, arms still outstretched, turns toward the camera. His image is in black and white, and the grain is nearly broken. It looks like one of the pictures they use for psychological testing, or some strange beast. A monster. The image freezes as last words roll and stop mid-screen. A Steve Harmon film.
December, 5 months later. It's 5 months since the trial, almost a year, minus a few days, since the robbery in the drugstore. James King was sentenced to 25 years to life. Osvaldo was arrested for stealing the car and sent to a reformatory. As far as I know, Bobo is still in jail. My mother doesn't understand what I'm doing with the films I'm making. I've been taking movies of myself. In the movies, I talk and tell the camera who I am, what I think I'm about. Sometimes I set the camera up outside and walk up to it from different angles. Sometimes I set the camera up in front of a mirror and film myself as a reflection. I wear different clothes and sometimes try to change my voice. Jerry likes to use the camera, and I let him film me too. Whatever I do pleases my mother, because I am here with her and not put away in some jail. After the trial, my father, with tears in his eyes, held me close and said that he was thankful that I did not have to go to jail. He moved away, and the distance between us seemed to grow bigger and bigger. I understand the distance. My father is no longer sure of who I am. He doesn't understand me even knowing people like King or Bobo or Osvaldo. He wonders what else he doesn't know. That is why I take the films of myself. I want to know who I am. I want to know the road to panic that I took. I want to look at myself 1,000 times to look for one true image. When Miss O'Brien looked at me, after we had won the case, what did she see that caused her to turn away? What did she see?
Hello, this is Walter Dean Myers, the author of Monster. I had checked the appointment time, put fresh batteries in my tape recorder, and gone over my questions carefully. Still, as the bus rattled through upstate New York toward Greenhaven Prison, I was nervous. I had never interviewed a multiple killer before. Over the next months, I would interview men who had been convicted of murder, stick-up men, prostitutes, and drug pushers. My questions would lead, I hoped, to one answer. What would lead a person from complete innocence to criminal activity and, eventually, to prison? After accumulating some 600 pages of interviews, I came to notice a common thread that no one went from being completely innocent to committing a major crime in one dramatic step. There always seemed to be interim stages, decisions to bend the rules along the way to ignore minor laws. Young men who successfully negotiated minor infractions, such as bullying or truancy, would often move on to petty thefts or street corner drug sales. Each rule-bending experience, basically involving the absence of a positive moral decision, would provide a kind of permission for the next act. Eventually, a line would be crossed in which the probability of getting caught would be the only governing restriction. Monster is the story of 16-year-old Steve Harmon, who has given himself the luxury of what seems to be a minor involvement in the crime. He has little to do in this caper, and the reward of being an in-member of a rough crew is tempting. But for Steve, as for so many of the young people I interviewed, things go terribly wrong. In Monster, Steve digs deeply within his own soul, searching for the moral awareness that he has allowed to elude him. Using the form of a movie, Steve plays back the events that led to the death of a drugstore owner and to his being on trial. He wants to reaffirm his own innocence, but learns that innocence, once lost, is not easily regained. The idea for this book came to me most clearly as I sat in a nearly empty courtroom watching the trial of a 17-year-old young man charged with armed robbery and attempted murder. From the open courtroom window, I could see the local high school, where kids were pouring out into the warm day. The sounds of their laughter drifted into the wood-paneled courtroom, while, on the stand, a witness pointed out the frightened young man sitting at the defense table. At that moment, Monster was born.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Monster by Walter Dean Myers. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Charles Potter. Copyright 1999 by Walter Dean Myers. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment, it's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.